This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with Salmon Fish. We're going to be talking about a number of things, including my review of Kostin Alamariu's Selective Breeding and the Birth of Philosophy. Salmon Fish, great speaking with you.
Hi.
So you're a Passage Prize winner. You describe yourself, and you list a lot of things in like the written introduction. OG manga, Zen master warrior, Buddhist, avant-garde artist, a Christian, a Renaissance man, a Jungian. If you just want to kind of start things off by just giving a brief introduction to yourself.
So the way that I kind of describe myself is just as myself.
Like a lot of people like to get grouped in with these different scenes. You're not with any like online political or cultural tribe.
Well, I mean, if you want to put it in some kind of political terms, it's more like an American philosophy to do with pigeonholing yourself and kind of the historical old world caste systems and entitlement systems, like systems of noble titles, that kind of thing. And then you look at like American history, and a lot of these great men are very hard to describe in simple terms and do many different things throughout their life and can't really just be described as like a professor or a doctor or something. So I think the correct level of analysis is the individual character.
Right. I think, well, it makes things easier to kind of pigeonhole people, and people are just tribal by nature. So people, there are all these different online tribes. So like, we're talking about Bronze Age perverts, so like the Baptists, they're one example. Like the Groypers are one, and then there's the kind of NRX crowd that revolves around Yarvin, which I guess they're sort of loosely tied with BAP. Then you have like MAGA, and you have like Wignats, and you have like Third Positionists, just all these different like online tribes.
So I'm not anti groups in general or agreeing on
people are tribal by nature, so they're inevitably going to form.
Well, my take on it is kind of you could even get into like race a little bit. I just think that white guys and certain groups have more of a predisposition towards like a primary independent mindedness and then like a secondary kind of collective characteristic. So I'm not anti-group thinking in general, but in my read of life and in my experience, like your own family members, even at times, you kind of can't rely on other people, primarily. And it's always you who has to take action, in your own life. And frankly, it's like literally impossible for other people in any regard to do certain things for you, to derive, full satisfaction and success in life.
I posted an article on my Substack, a review of it's Kostin Alamariu, who basically, it's pretty obvious, is BAP, and his book is called Selective Breeding and the Birth of Philosophy. So it's about a lot of things, but about his theories, Kostin's theories about philosophy and nature and breeding, how they're all interlinked, and he's fundamentally a Nietzschean, so a lot of Nietzschean themes about like slave morality as being removed from nature. And obviously BAP is very funny and entertaining. There is a lot of value to be added about his themes and about vitality and accept being exceptional, but to start things off, like, what do you like about BAP? Where is BAP right?
I definitely agree with health and vitality, excellence. I definitely agree with a lot of, I mean, not only him, but a number of other people, their critiques of, I guess you could say, like, neoliberal excess, like, unbounded kind of anti-civilizational thinking or emotionalism, if you want to go into that. I agree with, like, the dysgenic kind of collapse, feedback loop type stuff that's going on, like, the critique of all that. So I do feel characters, like Yarvin and BAP and, Nick Land and, you know, a lot of the favorites, I guess you could say, in the, dissident right or just kind of dissident sphere more broadly, really do have a lot to kind of say. But I think that a lot of the problem of politics or culture in general is not so much the agreement on the various critiques, but the proposed solutions are often the sticking point with a lot of stuff.
So you're saying both, like, both BAP and Yarvin, their solutions, because I think they're excellent as far as a critique, but no one really, like, has a clear solution. I think with, obviously there is a lot element of LARPing to BAP, because, like, what I say in the article is, like, the people who follow them, they tend to be more, like, the sensitive, like, kind of nerdy types. I mean, obviously some of them, I'm sure maybe some of them are, like, actual bodybuilders, but in general, they tend to be more the sensitive nerd types who sort of fetishize the warrior cast, and so it basically, like, becomes, like, LARPing. And then also, like, BAP really believes, as far as, like, what a meritocracy or eugenics should reward, like, BAP really believes in, like, the rule of, like, the warrior or the martial caste. And there are definitely, like, just as there's problems with, like, the rule of the merchant or the managerial class, there are potential problems from that. And I think, like, one way to look at it, like, communism is an attempt of rule of the rule by the proletariat, but then it morphs into a more kind of managerial bureaucratic structure. Capitalism's ruled by the merchant, and then fascism is ruled by the warrior caste. And I think all of those models have problems. So generally, like, what I'm in favor of is, like, what Plato advocates for, like, proportional inequality or a tripartite system. So you have, like, these different castes share power, like spiritualists, artists, even merchants, warriors. So basically no archetype totally, like, dominates society politically, culturally, and spiritually.
Yeah, I generally agree with that. Actually, like, this gets into my art a little bit. So some of what I have tried to do with
this... And
that's
what you won the Passion Prize for.
Yeah, so I kind of saw this niche that wasn't filled, which was to kind of just raise memes to an art form. So rather than doing the kind of opposite of that, to kind of lean into things is often, in my opinion, somewhat useful. But some of the stuff that I tried to do is, like, seize aesthetics and portray in a sense, you could call it a Jungian kind of vision of the world using...
Oh, so you borrow from memes and then you use the memes to reflect upon different Jungian archetypes.
And not merely archetypes, but a vision of how things in this world that are in conflict and generally coexisting, even hatefully, like, somehow reside in the same world. Like, there's all these things that just exist side by side to each other in nature. Like, so while some great conflict is going on in a foreign country, there's, like, some person in, like, bumfuck Arkansas that is just, like, kind of hanging out eating Cheetos, you know, in some nuke town type middle of nowhere.
Oh, so you're kind of like, you mean, like, kind of like Baudrillard's simulation?
Yeah, so I am trying to portray that with, I mean, you could call it a simulation, an image, that kind of thing, because I do feel like there is a kind of Jungian challenge to some extent in creating a proper mental model of the complexity of the world. It just all coexists, like, different religions, different political systems flowing through time. Like, all these different things have existed or literally contemporaneously coexist with each other, and So finding these underlying patterns and making some sense of how these things coexist to each other, or seeing like maybe the real nature of certain things behind a gloss or a facade or a story, and how these things interrelate to each other. I think that's like really important, a kind of paradoxical thinking that is particularly difficult for people.
And it's also kind of like how there's like liberal postmodernism, but then also a right-wing postmodernism. So sort of collage art is a metaphor for how people craft their political ideologies.
Or schizo. You could call it schizo.
Yeah, or like, have you heard the term like the, I think there was a scene, I forget who coined it, like the acid right?
Yeah. I know some of these guys too. There's definitely some, I don't know, there's a whole vein of things. Like, I'm from Ohio, I'm not going to give particular coordinates exactly, but I've been to festivals, I've been in the woods, like, there's some interesting kind of, like, psychedelic veins, some kind of, I think the more shallow, like, conserva bros would have a problem with some of the more esoteric stuff and would code it as, like, left-wing, like, some of the origins.
Yeah, like, I think, like, a lot of conservatives are Philistines, and, like, they'll actually dismiss anything interesting or esoteric, they'll flat-out dismiss as left-wing. But it's interesting, but, I mean, even, like, Ernst Jünger, who was, you could say he was a fascist, was, like, interested in psychedelics.
Yeah, I mean, I've done some kind of pioneering work in the treatment of depression and PTSD and that kind of stuff, where I sort of realized, like, it's like a kind of full circle type thing. It's like level one is common sense, level two is psychedelic and nuts, and level three is back to common sense almost. So it's like the use of psychedelics to treat depression and anxiety and that kind of stuff, the way they're going about it is very much the old pharmaceutical model of things, where you get a monthly treatment or whatever. And the problem is that the way your emotional systems work is very particular and corresponds to the type of objective universe that we live in.
And it's unique to the specific person. So I think, like, psychedelics are potential to be dangerous too. So obviously, like, ideally it should be in a controlled environment.
Well, no, I'm not anti-psychedelics, nor am I advocating. I'm also not against certain pharmaceuticals. People might get me wrong in that. What I'm saying is, like, you're depressed because you feel bad because there are bad things happening in your life. Like, if your relationships are unstable, it's all very boring in a sense. Like, if your economic situation is unstable, various, just necessities of life. Maslow's hierarchy is not entirely accurate, but it's something like that. Like, you're just not fulfilling certain things, or you are in danger some type of way, and you feel bad naturally to kind of alert you to that problem so that it can be addressed. So psychedelics can break you free of a plateau or a stuck frame, but if you don't land on a coherent frame, so like this notion of like ego dissolution is kind of the problem of neoliberalism, where McKenna and all them were in a kind of crisis and address their problem, but created the next problem in the process, which often happens historically, like set up the conditions for the next problem to arise, because the rapid dissolution of ego through the pushing of these kind of edgy at the time and accelerated methods caused, an ego dissolution, which thus leads to like a loss of coherence and standards. And then with like the Cold War and everything, you'd get a mass demoralization and subversion. That what exactly was the organizing principle and purpose behind that? And now we're just kind of like left with a large demoralized mass. And that term clearly expresses that you need some kind of framework to maintain sanity and be able to respond to your environment. So it's a problem, because I've seen people just like fall into bonfires, like completely spun out. And that's when I kind of realized, ego dissolution is not exactly correct. It's more like you need an ego because it's a survival mechanism. And you need to just like, and I'm just, this is for, humorous purposes, I guess, but it's like, you need to talk to your mother type stuff. Like, you can get Freudian about it. Like, you need to just kind of, I don't know, like, going to the gym is not optimal in my opinion. I would rather people like lift heavy things and get paid for it. But that type of stuff helps with emotional regulation for like young men, which would make a dramatic improvement. Whereas psychedelics can cause you to become completely insane, and I've seen it at least 50% of the time.
And you've tried psychedelics.
Yeah, I've done all kinds of things. I was very, I guess you could say like rigorous or scientific in my approach to things, whereas many of my friends were not and just wanted to get like fucked up, man. Obviously it's a bit of a seedy misadventure, in trap houses and all this kind of stuff, which I just smoke cigarettes and drink tons of coffee, anymore because I'm doing other projects, but I approached it scientifically and never got like addicted to anything at all. I just wanted to understand firsthand different altered states of consciousness and, kind of catalog and try and understand these things better, because in my life, I had a huge pain in the ass, which I think is extremely common in our sphere, but is not talked about, like the devouring mother archetype. Like you're not doing anything wrong, but they try and hit you with that like mental illness game when you're not, you know, when they can't say that you're like some kind of prison pipeline individual. And so like I've had to deal with people just socially trying to call me schizo or whatever a million times simply because of this perspective game, this like relativistic, psyop-y, subjectivist, arguing on Twitter continuously game. And it's like, it doesn't matter how much evidence there is for anything. I run into it all the time. And just to tie that back to stop the rambling forever thing, this is how I did actually counter signal BAP like one time, and World's Greatest Dad made a note of that. It was years ago or whatever, but, our brains, the structure of our brains, like our limbic system, autonomic nervous system, really does correspond to a particular type of world. So, you know, that helps address the issue.
It's almost like there's almost something kind of Gnostic about it where we subconsciously have this visceral feeling that something's wrong, but like we struggle to really even get into our subconscious. So it's get into our subconscious and figure out what the problem is. So it's relevant to Jung, but it's relevant to Freudianism. It's relevant to like Gnosticism, and ironically, like wokeness CRT, where they talk about implicit bias. Like, even though that stuff is like anti-white, they are touching on something interesting, that people do a lot of things via subconscious motives. And I think to really become like enlightened and healthier psychologically, because like I don't want to sound too much like a rationalist, because I think instinct's important, but to kind of like, but you do want to understand, like, if you feel something is inherently wrong, like, to really get in touch with that subconscious motive. And sometimes they're just obvious truths, because, like, I'll give an example, like, kind of like with politics, where maybe I was younger, I had, like, these inherent truths, but I lacked the courage to... Well, or maybe I felt pressure to conform to some political tribe, but like everything that I know now, there's a sense that there is, that I had that hidden knowledge the whole time, and there's something really almost kind of, you could say like, almost Gnostic about that.
Yeah, in my experience, it's like there's no way to advocate this exactly, but sometimes you just kind of got to be broken by things to be liberated from that stuckness, you know, like, you know, the whole time, but you're internally contradicted, which is again, well laid out by Jung, how people are kind of like a big soup of information and take like multiple positions until you actually settle on something and are in internal conflict with yourself. So yeah, I mean, sometimes you have to just like get stabbed in the back like 100 times, and then you really are just forced by circumstance, by nature, which does tie into Nietzsche and a lot of this stuff. But since we're there, it's like nihilism feels bad, and I think that's one of the most important.
I'm not a nihilist, but nihilism serves a temporary purpose as like a wrecking ball to clear out a lot of bullshit, if you want to call it slave morality. But then nihilism also wipes out the good too, so it's like, it's sort of a trade-off, but nihilism is bad long-term, but temporarily it serves a purpose to kind of clear out a lot of bullshit. We're kind of going for that now, like how, kind of like how the right used to be like hyper-moralistic, and there is a more nihilistic and Nietzschean streak on the right now, and kind of like how a lot of people attracted to the dissident right, it's more, like it's more about just being offensive and for the sake of it, but there is this kind of wave of nihilism for the culture that impacts the mainstream and like the dissident sphere, and it serves a temporary purpose.
Yeah, I see it as a kind of collective unconscious shadow processing event. So it's like crisis psychology. A lot of the shadow has to do with, well, I would never do that. Everyone would, and you actually have to dig significantly deeper to have the willpower or like spiritual conviction to not eat your friend's body when you're trapped in a snowstorm and die instead, kind of stuff. People act like they would never do things, and it's like if you were in an extreme crisis position, you kind of would, is some of the realizations of psychology. That's my dog sneezing. So it's just like, what I think is kind of happening right now is the struggle is intensifying in this kind of great conflict that we're in. It's sort of a crest of a wave almost. And that is kind of crushing people, which is one of those uncomfortable truths, because the best in our sphere, whatever you want to call it, have the ability to withstand the crushing weight of everything, at least somewhat sufficiently. But all these normies and kind of conservative masses and such, like, really aren't, they're lacking all kinds of things, like knowledge, just low information, which you kind of need to be able to contend with and do certain things to successfully not get psyoped and sideswiped and smashed by various kind
and
of
I
practical...
I think with, like, psyops, they're a lot... I think explanation for, like, psyops is they're not necessarily, like, I think maybe, like, you could say conspiracies do exist in some situations, but often they're not direct, deliberate conspiracy theories, but they're examples of a collective conscious. So if you study, like, evolutionary psychology and you kind of link it to Jungianism, like, groups of people and institutions, they take on a collective, they become a collective subconscious that does things inadvertently, but it's not necessarily like a deliberate conspiracy theory.
Right, and I'm pretty much willing to take phrases or memes from anybody, including straight supervillains. So just whatever you think of Tucker Carlson, he made a point about a conspiracy of instincts, which is kind of a really interesting idea because we do share a lot of brain regions in common. And that can account for a lot of stuff. So if you want to come at it from a mystical or an archetypal perspective, sometimes also the kind of just neuroscientific or biological perspective is very useful because it's like everybody has an autonomic system. Even psychos basically have somewhat of a functioning lizard navigational system, stress and whatever, because you kind of can't survive. Like the people that have, what is that, pica or whatever it is, where you can't feel pain, that's very, very hard to survive like that. So I do see this whole thing as kind of, you know, a collective processing and a kind of peak of a great conflict, like a peak moment. Not that it's going to stop. It's probably going to go down and then up.
It's the same way with the conspiracy. Like, there's conspiracy theories like the Illuminati or the anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, and like the way like power elites function is not conspiratorial, but like where each person in an elite institution becomes, they function like a cell and they take on a role, but they're not necessarily like scheming in some conspiratorial sense. They maybe, they're doing their job and they're responding to incentive structures, but it is like, but they're sort of functioning more like cells and organisms, not the way, like, it's not like the way, like, conspiracy theorists think, where there's this tiny group in a dark, shadowy room who plans everything that happens.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't want to be contrarian and emphasize the opposite. In fact, I think it's largely structural, like geopolitics and economics is, for example, just you know, picture a general kisses ass his entire career. He's been there forever. Like, there's, you know, there's nothing else to do. You've been there for 30 years or whatever it is. And then one day they just, like, hand you, after you've had a million documents, like classified documents and blah, 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 one day they just kind of hand you a document like, okay, you're a general now. Here's this piece of paper. It says it's just a type of way, and thus it has to be some type of way. You know, like, because of, I don't know, like, money and infrastructure and whatever. So, like, the arrangement of the planet is just kind of the way that it is. And so I think a lot of it is kind of like pirates with knives at each other's throats. Like, everyone at the table doesn't like each other, kind of necessarily. Like, China and Russia, they're all looking out for their self-interest, and everybody just comes to the table. Like, you get your way to the table with having some kind of fuck you button and, like, knives at throats. Like, it can be anything. It could be like, you know, Russia supplies oil to China, and that really sucks for us if that oil doesn't go to China. Push the sanctions too much.
Back to BAP, or Kostin. What's interesting is he, like, there is a critique. Would you say that he has an agenda to try to prove that Plato had the exact same philosophy as Nietzsche? You think that's a critique of, do you think, did you get the impression that BAP was trying to do that? Because there's some overlap, but I think he pushes that too far, that Plato is the same as Nietzsche, when there actually are some fundamental differences.
I mean, I kind of see what he's getting at. So it really depends if you want to emphasize differences or sameness, because a lot of things are very much the same in certain patterns. Like, if you dig deep enough, a lot of things are very related, if not kind of the same vague school almost. So, you know, there's definitely something to be said for Platonism, Neoplatonism. I personally think that BAP is doing a great job. We largely agree on a lot of things. Like, seizing aesthetics is probably far more intelligent than being, like, counter-feminine or something, like anti, you know, kind of whatever, it's esoteric, like just feminine coded or something, like aesthetics, you know, which is probably far more intelligent in a practical sense to help with birth rates and social circumstances.
Like the intuitive, well, the aesthetic, then also the intuitive, rather than these people who just use these buzzwords like anti-feminism or anti-liberal, appealing more to the aesthetic, ethereal, and the intuitive is more effective. So that, I mean, that is really where BAP's strength is.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to dig into grammar and communication, yes, it is infinitely more effective to be humorous and kind of, he's sort of a, I don't want to, because this is almost like the Carter, you know, it's like where that chick calls Wayne a poet and he's like, get the fuck out of here. You know, but it's like he's kind of a savage poet in a way. He's kind of like a barbarian poet, which I think is a much more intelligent form of communication than...
He's also, I'd say a satirist. I mean, he's pretty funny. Especially
yeah,
in his podcast.
But it's just like, if you can't connect with people, then what good are you at communicating? A lot of smart people cannot communicate with regular people, and, or just even, they can't even communicate amongst the various intelligentsia that... It's like, well, what, I, you know, you have this whole specialty full of jargon. I have no idea what you're saying. There's like five people that know what you're talking about. Can you please reduce it to some kind of American slang, please, you know, so I can understand what the hell you're talking about? And that's what I think the strength in communication is. It's way better than a hyper pigeonholed jargon minded, like, I guess, code language and stuff like that has its benefit to keep people gatekept because they can't understand what you're saying. But on the flip side, if you're trying to have some kind of mass effect or just some larger demographic effect, or even just trying to get like a, I guess you say, somewhat elite group of people that are capable of, you know, kind of like the end of BAP's book, like an order of knights. And then
you mean
even,
Bronze Age mindset.
Yeah, exactly. Or like a, you know, at the end there, he's like, okay, there's this like order of men vaguely. Or like even further, like an even more specialized type, which goes into the dark, corridors and corners of the world and deals with vice, like confronts it directly. And some of these kind of,
it's interesting is his attitude about degeneracy I think most of the, like, the trad right have very, very visceral reaction against anything degenerate or perverted, but he sort of embraces, like, the kind of the more, like, dark, chaotic energy that could come from perversions.
I really think that in that way, BAP is more classically American or even Christian than these trads are, because it's like, so you're going to deny that original sin is just a permanent feature of reality. You know, like, it's the American system was designed knowing that there's always going to be some low level fuck shit forever. And like all these other systems deny it or try and act like you can have some kind of, I don't know, new Soviet man or any of this stuff. But it's like, there's literally always going to be Pookie and Ray Ray. There's always going to be, you know, I got these cheeseburgers, man, like crackheads and all this stuff going on. There's just no way to analyze society intelligently without accounting
for... Yeah, like
for-
social conservatives are as can be dishonest about human nature as, like, the liberal... blank slightest.
Yeah, and so I think Machiavelli's kind of the answer to this, to the kind of Nietzschean conundrum, like the trad versus Nietzschean thing. I think Machiavelli, not his entire work, but just he kind of touched on this, that the turning the other cheek is not really higher order Christian principles. Like, you're not a good person for getting stomped on and facilitating and enabling the tyrants and the extremely negative elements. Like, he was right that you kind of need to, you know, don the red hat or like raise the black flag and start slitting throats every so often. Like, you have to learn the method and nature of these things and have a fuller picture. And I do think that's very much like the original American system in the sense of, like, I call it bounded liberty. So the problem that I'm kind of talking about today, like the longhouse and all this stuff, is neoliberal excess, essentially, where it's like unbounded, but there is no unboundedness to nature. Like, it's kind of defined by having a particular set of parameters and content, you know, like a tree is a tree and a squirrel is a squirrel type thing. And there's some variation.
And he's right about nature, because it's not so much like, it's not about being like a true nihilist, but the more time you spend in nature, the more grounded your morality is to the natural world. Where I think, like, on one hand, so I guess there's like these, what's kind of ironic is, so if someone spends a lot of time, like, watching porn, they'll become corrupted in one way. But if someone spends a lot of time online following, like, hyper-moralism, which could be, like, religious stuff, that could be a corruption in another way. So, but if you kind of touch grass, as a cliche goes, and spend more time in nature, then you get more grounded. You're more, I guess, I wouldn't even say morality, but like your psyche is more grounded in the natural world.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of different schools, I guess you could say, that have touched on the kind of loosey-goosey way that physics and nature actually works. So it's like, hold too tightly or too loosely and it doesn't work. You kind of have to get into a, I don't even know. It's almost like compensating back and forth between extremes. You kind of have to, because life is sort of defined by homeostasis and too hot or too cold and you die. So you kind of have to fluctuate naturally. You need some kind of concreteness while simultaneously having some kind of, you know, fluidity. Like, you have to be coherent and in touch with, like, I guess you could call it time or just the unfolding of movement and events. And yeah, I think that, again, that bounded liberty notion, at the beginning of America was pretty good, because it's like, there is going to be degeneracy. And I think there was like kind of a...
I also think different things work for different people, because the problem about moral systems is people are genetically different. So a morality will match up with a different genetic profile. But the problem is, it's hard to create like a moral system for everyone who's different, who, for so many people who are so genetically diverse. But it's kind of like, even Nietzsche said that master morality is not for everyone. Some people, actually slave morality is good for some people too. like different moral systems match up with different people depending on their backgrounds?
So my critique of the master morality situation is that a master is in a way a slave. You're kind of chained to your slaves, and so I really do have a problem with that as a schema, because it even gets kind of weird. It gets into like the red pill and almost feminist jargon of,
well,
like, there's all
the big irony is that the red pillars, they're trying to craft a persona of what they think, like, say, being like what they would call being an alpha male. So in a sense, the red pillars are actually, they're still enslaved just as much as a blue pill, someone who's like blue, quote unquote, blue pill does.
And I don't think that is really going to go away as some part of society. I mean, if you analyze it from the angle of adults, that's one thing, but it's like, okay, so children are born and they don't know anything. And so you can kind of look at it from that lens. Like, imagine trying to create a political system where ignorant children, like, are illegal type stuff. You know, like, there's just going to be people at various levels of development, stuck, you know, in various different types of ways. So I do kind of agree that, that should really kind of just be carefully allowed, sort of. Like, people are just going to be a stupid teenager, or who even cares, like 40 years old, and certain dimensions of their psychology are fixated and they're still struggling with various different challenges in their life, and some people will never get anywhere in their entire life. And then yes, there are natural inequalities. Some people have way more agency. Like, I'm not trying to pump up you and I, but we are noticeably more independent minded and willing to kind of just like have opinions that don't necessarily completely fit within the mold of the consensus. And
I'd say not just the mainstream consensus, but even consensus of online political tribes.
Right. And that's, I guess you could even say, like, that's been historically figured out. Like, that's the shaman or the artist. So there is almost a social role or allowance made for that type of thing in society, because they don't just like instantly mob.
But the problem is we have like all these disaffected people online who are pretty atomized, but we don't really have a real like artist or shaman. We have the archetype. We don't really have the role for that cast in society, because the conservatives are total Philistines and about culture and arts. And, or they have their own religion, which maybe has less, mainstream Christianity probably suppresses the shaman type as well. I mean, some might say Catholicism has that more than Protestants. That's like a whole debate. And then the left supports the arts, but then they have all this woke stuff and they don't really have a good shaman archetype either. Society really lacks that sort of like a role for like the artist or shaman cast, and obviously it is going to be at odds with, I guess, like the stereotype used to be that like artists were leftist, but in a sense, like, being an artist is kind of a spiritually elitist archetype.
Yeah, I mean, you're either in the gutter or at the top of the hierarchy, or a psychopomp that kind of walks between worlds, kind of casually. Whereas that's
like Ed Dutton had an interesting video. If you know who he is, the Jolly Heretic, the guy who does like the British guy who does like the HBD stuff, but that's kind of entertaining. And he said like also like artists and writers, authors tend to be high in like psychopathic antisocial traits, including like perversions.
Yeah, that's true, but also there's the element of, like, the tortured genius, like, the arrogant or tortured genius, like...
Yeah, you just for sure.
You struggle with the fact that you're
like, feel you have grandiosity, grandiose narcissism. I mean, there's also, like, an ethereal quality, too, to the arts, but this archetype, they feel superior, but they're not able to succeed, and they're tremendously resentful. And you see that with, like... You see that, like, in H.P. Lovecraft or Ezra Pound, even.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the struggles of high IQ or just genius, creativity, whatever that X factor is. You are an alien to people in some regard, and then you kind of have to focus on you have to associate with retards. You really do have to associate with just find people that have character and a heart, and just because their brain doesn't work like yours, just because they can't see what you can see. Otherwise, or find people that are intellectually capable or interesting, because there are those people.
Because I've noticed among people that I've had as friends and associates, like I've been friends with people on both extremes, like very successful people or people who would be conventionally described as losers, but like the middlings have been greatly underrepresented. That's like a big irony that I've noticed.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's definitely something to be said for the middle class or midwits.
All these fetish. That's kind of ironic because the populists are the ones who fetishize. They tend to kind of fetishize the middle class and have contempt for the top and the bottom.
I mean, they're literally just going to work every single day, which does make it time space kind of difficult for them to do anything other than this sort of frankly Federal Reserve based hamster wheel. Like, everything is continuous payments, you know. There's not as much solidness in this particular economic design, so people start to become really neurotic and go go go, and they don't pause and reflect, and they don't socialize as much, especially as the economy gets tighter. So you either have to have a bunch of money or not care and literally be a homeless schizophrenic if you need to have these conversations and to do these types of social things that require, free time.
And yeah, I think like besides Bap, another interesting person to talk about is Yarvin, Curtis Yarvin. I have a nuanced take on him because I think he's brilliant about describing the mechanisms of power, but his shortcomings are offering solutions, which just is the case of a lot of people. But he seems to want like oligarchs as monarchs, which I think is terrible. So his argument is that like corporations are more efficient at running things than the government, and in some ways that's true, but also but in other ways, like, it's the same bureaucratic managerial structures, but like he probably wants to see like Peter Thiel as like emperor, or even like some of the neoliberal like Silicon Valley elites. So you get like merchants and managerial elites as like an aristocracy. That's a horrific idea. But putting that aside, I actually do think I'm not anti Yarvin. I do think maybe like his prose is pretentious and he's maybe in some ways overhyped, but I do think there is value to Yarvin at the same time. I do think he's actually pretty brilliant as far as understanding a lot of the mechanisms of power.
Well, I mean, as somewhat of an insider, that's definitely the case, and I do really appreciate his critiques, especially of, you know, just kind of like democracy and these sort of basic entry-level concepts. But, you know, I think the running joke is sort of that he wants to be the corporate king, you know? I really do think that there's something to...
It's not that he wants to remove the current elite, but he wants to be them, and he believes that he can do a better job than them. But he's not fundamentally, like, against them, per se.
Maybe he could, or alternatively, he might be a little bit too likely to fuck with random levers and stuff. Like, I don't know. Personally, I would rather, like, myself just not have anyone over me. I don't want to be subject to anyone or anything, so I do just kind of come back to the kind of original American model of, like, I'm just going to leave you alone and you leave me the hell alone, and if it becomes my problem, then I guess I'm just going to personally do something about it.
The problem is that kind of Jeffersonian model, it's towards either agrarian or frontier society. Like, it's hard to make that work with higher population density or urbanism. But, like, Yarvin is interesting because I think his fantasy would be to have, like, New York or San Francisco, but as, where it'd still be very kind of swipple and hipster, but like a quasi-fascist city-state, or maybe even something a bit like Singapore. I think that's what like Yarvin and some of the other NRX types strive for.
Yeah, I my particular line of thinking on things is not like I don't know what you want to call it, like super progressive. The structures that exist, and I'm more of just like a realist. Like, okay, I'm not trying to create a utopia. Like, the things that exist. Economics are going to exist. Military something or another is pretty much always going to exist. So money, guns, pussy, drugs are going to exist. Those things are constants in real politique. Resources, food, water, all that stuff. So there's nothing that I really intend to do as far as radically leveling California or New York or something. But that's kind of on them. You live in California, don't you, somewhere?
Yeah, I do. So I don't necessarily want to see it level, but I think, I would say for California, I would support, like, something like enclavism or something comparable to, like, the Swiss Canton system.
Yeah, I think just some kind of balancing force. Like, the fact that you're even...
Or even making it, like, a territory like Puerto Rico, like, I would support that.
Well, I mean, realistically, what are you going to do about California, like, in any type of practical terms? You know, the demographics, the kind of economic, infrastructural situation, all this stuff. Like, I think people are very, very, like, there's a lot of LARPers, like you were saying. There's a lot of people that are ideologically so far out. It's like, how does that ever connect to reality? You know, like, what kind of actual thing can be done at all right now? And in the short and medium term, like, there's all these different people, many different ideas, all kinds of problems with, like, Newsom and all this crazy stuff. And so enclavism is potentially realistic, at least in some kind of short-term, like, workable proposal for things. Because, okay, I mean, realistically, like, the federal government structure and everything right now, I don't see any type of way politically and whatever in the short term to, I don't know, like, evacuate everybody out of California that isn't white or any of this stuff. Like, this makes no sense.
Yeah, that's like, people who advocate that are just so way out of touch with reality.
I'm just like, how are you going to get all these goons to do that? Let's be completely practical for a second. What are you talking about?
Yeah, even putting aside, like, any moralistic arguments, it's just totally impractical. But enclavism, on the other hand, that is something that I do see, like, even that runs into issues, like, with, like, legislation and regulations against freedom of association. But I think in a place like California, that's really the only way.
I mean, I guess you could kind of take a page out of Yarvin or some characters like that. You could do that completely privately, economically, without...
Yeah, I think he seems to want, like, city-states... Like, the idea of, like, city-states that are run by, like, as, like, corporate charter cities. So that's... I think he is sympathetic to that idea, so I don't necessarily want, like, an enclave being run by a corporation, but I actually could see... I do predict that could happen in the future, where, like, someone like Elon Musk, as a billionaire, might build his own city, and it might... And then people become kind of his subjects. So it is like a neo-feudalism.
Well, I mean, sure, maybe that's how it goes down. But I just mean, like, you can kind of use the mechanisms at hand in terms of private economics and whatever, freedom of association. Like, you could call it like white flight type phenomena, or self-segregation, that stuff just happens naturally. So I think if you're kind of realistic about how things naturally unfold, but then there is the problem of, like, what land is available, like, what incentive structures, what language do you use? Like, I personally think everybody's really unrealistic. Like, even if you could build Wakanda, because actually millions of black people seem to be overtly calling to build Wakanda and want to go there, which I think would potentially be a thing. It's like, do you think there's not going to be any, what, like, black people in, like, black people go to Japan, don't they? They go to different countries. There's some small percentage of people of different.
But the thing is, you're never going to have like the people who advocate like 100% racially homogenous ethno states like that. That's never going to happen. Like the way enclavism works is different communities will cater to a group, but there might be some modest diversity. So even like you might have like Chinatown as an enclave, and it might just be maybe 70% Chinese. So that's like how enclavism works. It's not like 100% total like separatism.
Yeah, when has anything historically been completely?
Even like the alt-right, they give Israel as an example. They complain about the double standard, how Israel's an ethno state, but even Israel is maybe like, you could say they have like a quasi-apartheid in the West Bank, but at the same time they do have like Arabs who are Israeli citizenship, so it's not like a total ethno state either.
Yeah, to kind of de-emphasize that freaking out neurotic energy, like how many countries are effectively ethno states, and in that way Israel's not particularly unusual.
Only example I can think of is North Korea.
I mean, I don't know. Like, I just, any country is kind of majority, whatever race type thing. Or, I mean, I know there's subdivisions, but it's like, go to Africa. How many black people are there? You know? Unless you want to talk about like South Africa or something. But yeah, like every country that's ever existed has been sort of an ethno state. Like, pretty much. I mean, you get empires every so often that do keep running into this, like, how do we balance these forces? I think Rome was completely insane for stealing the Greek pantheon and just renaming it. That must have been the biggest absurdity to those people, that they just, what the hell is that?
So both Bap and Nietzsche are very anti-Christian, and you identify as a Christian but have, like, views that are maybe unconventional from, like, what people think of as, like, a fundamentalist Christian. But I think what's interesting is, like, there are these, like, Christian archetypes versus Promethean archetypes, and they both have different variants. So I think, like, even within Christian archetypes, you might have one that's more loving and one that's more, like, stern and strict. And then Promethean archetypes could include, like, and that overlaps with Nietzschean archetypes, but it includes, like, radical creativity and embracing chaos or rejecting, like, slave morality. But it could also include, like, something like eugenics. I know Christian fundamentalists hate dualism, but on the other end, I've interviewed Jason Residor Johnny, and he's vehemently opposed to Christianity and any kind of dualism with Christianity. I think a few thinkers, like maybe like Rudolf Steiner, have promoted this kind of dualism between like a Christian and a more like Promethean or Nietzschean, but I actually do really embrace like dualism, and I think dualism is needed to sort of navigate, well, different metaphysical realms, but also to navigate just day-to-day life.
Yeah, I think Jung really nailed it. What was that? Aeon, that book Aeon, where he's talking about like Christ assumed the seat of Rome, kind of archetypally, and has not been removed since.
Because even if you take the Bible, like, one hand, like, you could say Christ says, don't serve two masters, could be described as against dualism, but then render unto Caesar could be described as embracing dualism. So there's a lot of different ways to look at it.
I think people, again, really have a problem with kind of the conjunctio oppositorum. Things are not necessarily utterly contradictory, but flip sides of a coin. So I really don't see there's any problem with, you know, the gods with a lowercase g existing. I mean, there's local spirits to like Japanese, you know, spirits and all these different things. It's like, I don't really see any reason why there can't be like localized lesser spirits or entities. I don't see any reason why that's a problem, like that there's a rich cornucopia of things that exist in a spiritual, metaphysical, material way. There's all kinds of stuff. I don't see how that's really a contradiction.
And I think dualism is needed in politics. So I think like a more like right, a more kind of right-wing view is needed in some situations, but a more egalitarian view is needed in others. So I think politics, needs dualism as well.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely had to do with my work in the Passage Prize, where it's like, you know, if you look at politics in America right now, there's kind of a funny thing with George Washington advocating that we don't have, like, a two-party system, because I'm not even really sure he predicted this, but over time it seems to have reduced itself to the fundamental human division of just male and female on some level, or, like, the esoteric masculine and feminine energies, and it's like...
It's like yin and yang, and I joked that, like, the ideal is to back both Marianne Williamson and Donald Trump as, like, opposite archetypes, and to embrace them both.
Yeah, Marianne Williamson was lightweight entertaining, actually.
Voted for her.
Yeah, she was actually really interesting. I don't care what anybody
said. She actually said something that politics are a product of the people, which is unintentionally really based.
I was saying back then, it's like they should have put Marianne Williamson up there. I thought they were completely nuts in how they handled the primary, but, you know, that was my suggestion. It's like I'm negotiating with demons sometimes. I'm like, you don't like anybody, but, like, for your just own self-interest, like, that would have been the best move. I don't get it.
So, like, with Kostin's book, Selective Breeding, he talks... It does get into, like, eugenics versus blank slateism, so there is, like, eugenics in practice and hypocrisy about how people are hyper-moralistic about the concept. But I think what's interesting is that blank slateism, it doesn't actually create a more egalitarian society. It actually just masks hierarchies and inequality.
Yeah, I do have a kind of Christian critique of that whole situation. So I think the founders were talking about a kind of deeper existential level, or even like a transcendental level, in which we are already inherently and in all times and places equal, just on the level of, like, I think people are extremely confused as to what the hell the Constitution
But if you take, like, spiritually, like, a good way to look at it is there's this dualism because people are genetically different, but when you go down to the smallest particle, everyone is made up of these, like, tiny atoms or particles of energy. So that explains, like, that it has to be. When talking about these really touchy issues like hierarchies, eugenics, blank slateism, again, like, there has to be, like, a dualism there.
Yeah, just in practical political terms, the old world caste systems were very rigid, and it is just true that people have a tendency to just come from absolutely anywhere and do something completely revolutionary, and not having the ability, like, a long time ago, Harvard decided that they were going to start, like, a essentially student loan or, like, grant system to get those smart people out of the gutter, because, you know, back when things were kind of sane almost, like, well, he's a complete genius, but he works at the local insurance company or something.
Oh, yeah, like, I don't know if you've seen that, I wrote that article about, like, the intelligent but poor, but the problem is... capitalism is insufficient to necessarily reward intelligence in all cases. There's going to be intelligent people who are poor, but it's a failure of capitalism, but also liberal egalitarianism means that you can't help intelligent people who are poor either.
My advice is to seize it for yourself in those cases by some means, because there are natural mechanisms that are kind of outside of the insufficient systems to seize for yourself. Like, you can just make art. Like, a great deal of art is something you can just make with not that much money, with just a small hustle, like digging holes or turning wrenches. Alternatively, with the internet, you can educate yourself a lot. I mean, it's very hard to parse all the information, but even then, it's a great degree of knowledge just floating around and accessible in everybody's pocket. So you really could, because, I mean, I have this whole physics theory recently, which is completely crazy in its implications. And that idea is just there now to be tested by whoever the hell. And that's what you can just do that, you know. You can just kind of put a meme out there, and then it's just there.
You mentioned that you were initially a Trump supporter, MAGA, and you became disillusioned with Trump. But the thing is, like, some people are saying Trump is a Manchurian candidate, but I think there's a lot of factors. I think some of it is his age and just being a boomer, and then a lot of it is that just that he's still fundamentally linked to conservatism, which is fundamentally about, like, maintaining the status quo. So do you actually think Trump is a Manchurian candidate, and can you kind of explain why you were initially a Trump supporter and became disillusioned with MAGA, and the story about what MAGA was from the beginning?
Okay, so might as well start at the beginning. I was in Ohio, which, like, the whole election really came down to a very particular demographic of, like, independent-minded young white males, just in terms of not only the voting demographics, but the cultural context at the time here in Ohio and how that influence worked, essentially. So it was really kind of like me and my random weirdo friends that were the demographic that ultimately decided the election. And that was a weird position to be in. And so the story from the very beginning is actually different than a lot of these conservative masses, the various Q clingers on, the kind of late to the party people that showed up and started grifting. Like, these ideas aren't theirs. Like, they,
because what if I think a lot of them, like, I think Ben Shapiro was initially anti-Trump. He was like a Ted Cruz supporter, or, like, same with Matt Walsh, like all these people who were initially skeptics of Trump from the old guard Republican Party, and they basically hijacked MAGA.
Well, that's where I have, like, kind of a complicated perspective, because what is happening right now, in my opinion, is that the neocon machine is essentially making its move to seize back control by many different means. Because kind of what's happening is that a lot of people are lost, I guess you could say, delusional, living in false narratives, are not up to date on critical variables and, like, time sensitive things that are happening. It's just way too much for a lot of people to process cognitively to keep up with, which is just an inherent problem of some of this. So my disillusionment or whatever with Trump, I was here from the very beginning. I remember Styx and Scott Adams and Lionel and all these characters, like, all these new people do not really understand what took place from the very beginning of all this. And so there's, like, a whole nother layer of the story that people are just really not aware, like, how, like, hippie revivalists had, like, a huge amount to do with some of these ideas. Like, they don't appreciate the nature of 4chan, like, how much more, I don't know what you want to call it. That place is like a radioactive wasteland of madness, you know, and
it just epitomized like pure epitomized like 4chan exists a pure chaos in a metaphysical sense.
Yeah, it's absolutely terrible in countless ways, and it's also a source of golden treasures. You know what I mean? There's so many things that come out of that roiling, chaotic, whatever you want to call it, like, decentralized system type thing, that it's just weird like that. And I just don't think the conserva bros and the trads and a lot of people appreciate, like, things are way more interesting in their inception than this kind of neocon machine politics. And then Trump's, like, out there selling golden sneakers to to get, like, the black vote or something. Like, what the hell, man? That's just straight old conservative machine politics. And it's like, you know, he's, like, out of touch. He's saying, like, TikTok is going to, you know, keep Facebook from coming back or something. The Zoomers are not going to Facebook. What are you talking about? You're a boomer. You're very out of touch with, like, how each generation seems to kind of jump onto new social media platforms. Facebook has been dead to the millennials for a fat minute. Why the hell would the Zoomers go there? They didn't. They went to TikTok and other things. So why would they go to, like, the boomer-controlled Facebook?
Yeah, there was, at the beginning, there was this kind of, like, almost like this Crowleyan, like, chaos magic at the very beginning of MAGA, which is not really there.
Yeah, you know, this is why I say things like Trump's clout doesn't mean anything, because it wasn't the man himself. It was having his thumb on the pulse. It was, you know, being attuned to real issues and ideas and things. And it's like, if you deviate from that, you lose the meme magic. And people don't want to face this, but, you know, it's like 20 or 30% of his hardened support has, like, disappeared. If you just go on the timeline, you can see all types of people criticizing him and turning away from support. And it's like, how does that affect electoral politics?
Like, it was a total shift in the profile, the profile of support. I do think there's a good chance Trump could get reelected, but I think he could very well be like a lame duck president with a lot of obstructionism. Like, there's a good chance he'd get elected, but there's these people promoting, like MAGA are promoting this conspiracy theory that the election's gonna get stealed, but I don't even believe in the whole stop the steal thing. I think Trump lost on his own merit because he lost the enthusiasm, plus a lot of demographic change is a factor too. But I think Trump lost on his own merit. I don't even buy into the whole stop the steal thing. But I don't agree with, like, the ultra-MAGA types that the election was going to be outright stolen. I think, actually, my prediction is that Trump will be reelected and allowed to be president, function as a safety valve.
I think it's a little bit bleaker than a safety valve. I agree that they're trying to put him into office, because who is really on the Democrat suite of options over there right now? Like, no one, if we're being totally real.
It's going to be Trump versus Biden. Like, you have these grifters saying it's going to be like Newsom or Michelle Obama. And then, well, the grifters on the right say it's going to be Newsom or Michelle Obama, or the grifters on the left say it's going to be Nikki Haley, but it's pretty clearly it's going to be Trump versus Biden.
Yeah, I don't see them, because I've done a lot of putting myself in their shoes, trying to figure out their perspective, which is, again, kind of the difficult psychology of, like, I don't agree with their perspective. I think they're insane in a number of ways, but trying to understand their perspective. I don't see them pulling those moves. Like, because in what way does it help them to put Michelle Obama up there or Newsom? Like, I think that causes a great degree of instability, and they can't afford that right
exactly.
Now, so they're really with Biden.
When we talked about the metaphysical and supernatural component to politics, but I think, like, science proving the supernatural is interesting. What if Altus had a really interesting, well, this applies, goes back to, like, Isaac Newton and, like, the Renaissance and to Hermeticism in ancient times, but, like, what if Altus had an interesting video, like, Operation Paperclip and, like, the CIA, like, actually proving the existence of, like, the spirit world with, like, astral projection and possibly, like, metaphysical realms?
From my life experience, I have definitely experienced a lot of supernatural things. I believe completely that it exists. I don't have the capacity to explain all of it, but I've experienced a lot of things at this point. And to tie it into, like, science, yeah, my recent experiences have been a lot more poetic and mystical than people generally take, like, cold rationalist science to be. This, like, black hole matter thing has been very weird, like, very, very interesting, just odd kind of poetic, almost feminine things associating to each other, like, just synchronistically kind of just like, oh, that makes sense all of a sudden, and that makes sense. And so it's a lot richer. I mean, just to go into it for like 2 seconds, black holes, macro black holes out in space are the same color as space. And it's like, why is space black? And why don't micro black holes eat us? Like, it's all like, to try and just take those three variables and make sense of it, like, it doesn't make any sense that, like, macro black holes would just exist and they're the same exact color as space. And, like, everybody's got these crazy theories, like, there's all this utterly nuts, like, whatever's in there has to be completely nuts, like, it either has to be so solid that you just, if you could get through the event horizon, you just crash into it and nothing happens, or it's some kind of multiverse utter and complete nonsense. And I think something was ruled out before science as such even existed, because as is often the case with human biology and psychology, like, it's not entirely rational. It was biological. We are only partially rational, and really only some of us. So it's like we didn't have any reason to perceive this biologically, because it kind of makes no difference for basic survival of an animal to be able to perceive atomic scale occurrences or all these strange physics phenomena. But I really do think that it explains entropy, to kind of look at space as a paradox. So it's simultaneously nothing, and you can fly right through it, but it's also the heaviest element that there is. And so the electromagnetic spectrum is probably circular and touches on some kind of like Higgs paradox at one end. And it really just kind of explains entropy and time in a way that nobody's been able to get at, and all this incredibly dense jargon and mathematics and whatever, again, back to just communicating like a regular person. You could look at space as being the bottom of an incredibly dense ocean of some kind of, it's like solid, but it's like water kind of in some way. It's some kind of like really Tao mega water type stuff, where entropy would just literally be things being torn off at their weakest link continuously by crushing pressure. And you could kind of like, well, why is it that we can just fly through it? Like, why is it that this regular matter and whatever this other stuff is, like, kind of coexist, because of like relatively equalized pressures kind of, and like everywhere is sort of the bottom of this probably infinite ocean, which is kind of weird geometrically and whatever. But it's like, if you think about a submarine at the bottom of the ocean, it's almost like the weight of the entire ocean is somehow being distributed onto the surface of this submarine, no matter where it is. And then as it moves, the water just bends around it, like, immediately, except it's even more Tao, in the sense that it's like so utterly immediate and fluid that you don't even notice that it's there, and you don't feel literally anything. But it would explain dark energy and dark matter. And I think it's like a huge deal if space is solid material, because that really sets up like a whole bunch of, I don't even know.
I have this post on my Substack. If you take something like near-death experiences, like, there is a strong scientific case for their legitimacy, because people are clinically dead. Their brains are basically shut down. Plus, people report experiences being much, their senses are much more vivid. It's not necessarily like a dream or hypnagogic. People have out-of-body experiences where they get knowledge that is true. Like, they see something happen in a room that actually happened. So there's fairly legitimate scientific evidence. But then the other thing is, like, they also contradict themselves. So some people have near-death experiences that are very Christian, about very rigid Christian views on salvation with heaven and hell. But then also much more common are these, like, universalist themes. So that's very confusing to people. But, like, one way, there's different interpretations of that. So there could be, like, many different metaphysical realms, including, like, afterlives.
Yeah, I don't think it's good practice to say that you know everything when you don't. So for me personally, I truly do not have all the answers on this stuff.
No one really does. It's all speculation. But how to sort of process this philosophically or even scientifically. And yeah, because I guess the point is, like, if you accept that near-death experiences are scientifically legitimate, but also that they theologically contradict each other, like, how do you explain that?
So that's kind of back to my art, like, what I'm trying to portray visually and communicate, that these things, like, the universe is far more mysterious and rich, I think, than people initially or even kind of culturally. It's like Kitsch. It's like Geo's book about Kitsch. Like, you just kind of have a reductive narrative for the normies, because that's kind of their approximate level of development and ability to kind of handle their own affairs and stuff like this.
You think about, like, most people you talk to people about this, they're either atheist, materialist, or they're very standard, have a very standard, generic, like, kind of almost like movie-like Christian view about heaven and hell. That's just how most people are.
Yeah, and that doesn't do literally any good in explaining all these things. You know, I mean, there's so many things, and it's kind of like the initial argument between Jung and Freud. Jung was basically saying, like, your framework does not explain all of these phenomena that we already have recorded, and so it's just not a broad enough or deep enough or open-minded enough
framework. It's like what we know is the tip of the iceberg. It's like the Neoplatonists have this concept called apophaticism, where it's like, it's different from agnosticism, but like the Neoplatonists believe that like what we know about God is like the tip of the iceberg. Like, in a sense, like, are you sort of a Neoplatonist?
Yeah, I mean, I'm an internet schizo. I've seen too many things to, like, my virginity is gone as far as that is concerned. I've seen so many things that I'm really focused a lot of the time on complexity and, like, chaos theory, because that's one of the main problems of the modern world, is the complexity is so great, and the, I guess you could call it like a sight-related technology. The internet has made people suddenly able to see all these things where historically that wasn't a thing. So this kind of early 2000s optimism.
It's
like
with the internet, we have like unlimited information, but like people only make use of a very small fraction. Like people can complain about like censorship, which is a huge problem, but even despite censorship, there's vast amounts of like information out there, even on Google, which is pretty shitty. And the thing is, the big problem is not actually the censorship, is that most people only make use of a small amount of information. Or they don't even, a lot of people just lack the intellectual curiosity. Or
right.
they can't mentally process it, even if they do access it.
Well, that's why I was talking to Gio about, like, seizing our own kitsch. There's a weird thing with, like, Daily Wire and all these characters like Peterson and everything, where they are sort of dissident kitsch, and they're kind
of... Peterson, like, he's even, like, really into Jung, as you are, but it's almost like he kind of dumbs it down to appeal, like, to the normie.
Right, and so it's like, these characters, I don't even know, it's mostly conservabros, that kind of thing, where it's like, they lean left or right, like there's kind of almost like a tug of war for the soul of these individuals in some mass way, because they can be useful, but also they can be the biggest problem at the same time, and it's like, Gio really does have a point about kitsch, like, we need to come up with some kind of common sense phraseology, some kind of, simple terms to explain a lot of this stuff, like you're explaining it to a child, like, don't start a fight, finish it. Like you really kind of need to reduce things to these, I don't even know, like, it's so simplistic that they don't have to know that BAP or Yarvin even exists. You know, we need to kind of have the intellectuals go completely insane and struggle terribly against the void and the complexity of everything, and then try and reduce it. Like, Terrence McKenna had a very special skill for traveling into hyperspace or whatever the hell it was, and then actually being able to communicate anything about the nature of that to people. That's a very specialized skill. So we really do need to kind of focus on kitsch and kind of the information ecosystem mechanisms, like the Daily Wire and stuff like this, where you kind of have to force them by circumstance to discuss certain issues. Like, they'll only talk about things when it's absolutely on the table.
Because the thing is, like, the Overton window has been shifted pretty far. Like, the Daily Wire is talking about, like, alt-right talking points from 2015 now.
Yeah, so it's like, it has to be kind of safe for the, I wouldn't even really classify Daily Wire as fair-weather patriots or that kind of thing. Like, it has to be either so in your face and completely unavoidable, or safe to discuss.
Yeah, like, either like totally watered down or like so in your face.
Right. So, because that whole machine there is kind of pushing to the lowest common denominator, which is part of the reason that I really prefer the method of having like few followers, and it's not for everybody. I just think having an enormous number of followers in most cases is exactly the type of thing that the Daily Wire is, which is not sufficient to the, I don't even know what you want to call it, incredibly difficult.
And like with Elon Musk, like the whole, where you can now make money off of your X posts or Twitter posts, like it's, I mean, some people can benefit, but it creates an economic incentive for reducing the quality of output, which is a problem. Even if like, I mean, I'd consider signing up for that and trying to benefit off that at some point, but it does degrade like the quality by creating a profit margin.
Yeah, you know, I know people want to be incredibly classy and sophisticated and everything, but if you go back to the hood, you get these like kind of really basic things that Klaus Schwab and all these people in their towers completely miss.
Like, mean, well, there is like the whole meme, like the bell curve meme, where the people at the top and the bottom of the bell curve get certain truths that the midwit misses. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, like how are you going to get every gang in America to stop using cash? That's completely insane. Like, how'd you miss that? Like, how are you going to get, you know, just like regular people to do or understand literally anything? It's, I don't know.
I was kind of posting about this, but do you think that like, that sex acts determine and set political paradigms?
I've actually talked to a lot of different types of people in my life, and I've talked to people that were like pretty high up in American politics, helping run various campaigns and whatever. I'm not going to disclose anybody's name or anything, but I directly ask strange questions like, okay, I think the vast majority of politics is some kind of like sexual thing. A lot of the time, like who's sleeping with who, and you know, that's a lot of the reason for things. And she's like, yeah, it's like 98% and whatever. The number doesn't really matter. It's maybe it's a little bit less or something, but it's one of those things where that's like information you never hear. You got to look for the things that are not there. Like you never hear anything to do with sex ever in politics, basically. Which kind of tells you like it matters in some type of way.
It's
so I really
you take like fetishes. They're degenerate, and like people on the right, like the trad right, they don't want to talk about degeneracy. But once you describe a specific like fetish, you are describing a specific political ideological power dynamic. So it is like you're exposing the unmasked.
Well, without getting too radioactive about it, it's like AOC has a white boyfriend. You see a lot of stuff like that. Like you can
I think
go to
like one thing. Like so, this. Like, one thing is that the whole is how, like, people are politically right-wing but aesthetically left-wing and vice versa. So, like, one, the contrast is you have, like, the rapper, kind of like the rappers for MAGA who are maybe aesthetically left-wing but they support Trump. And then on the other end, you have, like, Taylor Swift, who's a, she's a neoliberal icon, but she's also, like, aesthetically conservative in an aesthetic sense. And there's people who are kind of, like, who are politically liberal, but aesthetically and conservative in their mating choices. And the other, I mean, I guess, like, or the other kind of thing is, or things like, or then you get into things like genetics and, how like the populace hate the elite, but in some cases, but they have to create like a coping, kind of like a coping strategy, how everyone in the liberal elite is like ugly or dysgenic, when you might have like, you might have someone who fits like a right wing, sort of like beauty ideal, or like being like attractive and high IQ, but they're part of like the oppressor class of like the elite oppressor class, and there's all these interesting like dichotomies about like what is aesthetically or socially right wing, which versus like what people do in practice versus like versus people's like political alignment.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that is psychological stuff like sublimation. So a lot of the time the really, really clean freak, germaphobe girl boss will have like a shit fetish. or like wants to be really dirty in the bedroom and like keep that low key. You get a lot of like compensating factors sexually in psychology. I was listening to Alan Watts the other night, and he made a funny point about how Christianity imposing some kind of pressure and standards was to keep things sexy and edgy on some level. Which is really kind of funny if you think about that. Like this, woke, like everything goes, and it's like they're forcing all the doors of perception completely open. But the thing
also relates to, I'm not sure if you're familiar with like Colin Wilson, but Colin Wilson talks about like sexuality in terms of expanded like consciousness. So creating, having an intensity in like consciousness is how he views sexuality.
If you're gonna, try and talk to like a lot of modern people that don't have like high principles and all this stuff, you do kind of have to come at it from a almost hedonic perspective. Like it kind of seems crazy, but, doing the dishes might be like a sexual edge at this point. Like there's kind of almost like if you tear those boundaries completely open, then almost imposing boundaries just in like sexual foreplay and shit like this, just creating scenarios that are, I don't know, like just old school or whatever, like, but still, I mean, there's no getting away from modernity on some level. Like there's good points that have been brought up. I'm way more, open-minded about a lot of stuff, I think, than a lot of people. Like the feminists did have some arguments, but then like the experiment has gone completely insane in a lot of ways. You know, so I'm not so one-dimensional in my response to things. Like, I just think we kind of need to compensate in the other direction, to keep the sex, like the...
And back to that theme of, like, dualism.
Yeah, you know, I really just think that, yeah, it is sort of an interplay, back and forth in a lot of ways. Like, McKenna was trying to accelerate and dissolve all these boundaries because of what he called
the same with like race. Like you can be, I think with dualism, like you can be a racist at times, but then at the same time you can also be like a universalist at other times. Like those two, they're both legitimate.
And then you'll get called schizo a million times, and it's like they don't really contradict each other fundamentally in the way that people think. But again, that does actually keep coming back to tribalism. And in a sense, like, you know, elitism, like natural, inequality kind of elitism, not like nepotistic elitism, but like certain people just arise and have inequalities in life where it's like, yeah, you know, people just don't get that you can one moment like have one position and then the next have another, and they really don't contradict each other. It's a flowing kind of balance, like, and there's a complicated like natural order almost, like, that you have to align your mind with. Like, again, back to the founders, they really did kind of overtly say there is an inherent equality, which pretty much just means like you're a human being and you can, like, life is expression. So in some principle, you know, that the document corresponds to, like, it's just the acknowledgement of physical, like natural law, like you exist physically. That's all the First Amendment really means. The Second Amendment kind of means that every animal has an inherent capacity to fight. Like, it's just there. It has really nothing to do with any type of man-made authority system, and that's kind of what was cool about it. Like, it just respects some basic things. Like, yeah, you could come out of the gutter and be the next Tesla or whoever it is, and we just kind of wanted to loosen up the caste system a little bit, but not utterly.
Maybe the ideal is not like not a rigid, like rigid caste system like the Hindu caste system, but a flexible caste system that helps everyone find where they excel at.
Yeah, it's
there are major flaws with like the worship of the liberal capitalist meritocracy, because it's selecting. The problem with the worship of the meritocracy is you're really it's a lie, because you're focusing on specific traits like test taking.
I think that one's pretty interesting, racially as well, because if you look at India or China, their very high population might actually be confusing this issue a little bit, because, you know, at a certain point, there's almost like a meter, you know, it's like, okay, I like people. Okay. There's kind of a lot of people around here. All right. We really could use less people around here. And you don't have to like that or whatever, but there's definitely some element of that within a lot of people.
And I think, like, with India, like, it's because it's so crowded and hyper-competitive, I think the caste system there is a necessary evil, so people kind of stay their place. I think, like, if India eases the caste system but also becomes more capitalist at the same time, it will create this hyper-competitive nightmare. I think it could very well be a necessary evil. It might even have some good to it. I just think, like, I mean, ideally would want something maybe more flexible, but there, I really take issue with these people who worship, like, the whole idea of, like, meritocracy, especially, like, incentivizing for who does best in, like, a corporate environment or, I mean, nepotism is bad if it's centralized, but, like, nepotism can work if it's decentralized as well. So there's a lot of angles to consider.
So my point about that is kind of how, in all practical reality, they have to compete to some extent in those countries along lines of obedience or, like, institutional competition. So I think that gets confused because people are like, oh, Asians are really, really smart, or, like, Indians are, like, really, really smart. And it's like, not by default. I mean, it's just a population. Like, that's not going to broadly describe a population. I think what's happening is that they compete along lines of test taking and institutional competition. And they just, like, their families insist that they, become a doctor or become a lawyer or all this type of stuff. And frankly, I think that's kind of bad in America, at least in some ways, because it's like, well, what if they didn't want to be a doctor? Then they're probably not going to be a great doctor.
Right, right. Back to the whole sexuality thing is, do you think, we were talking about this on Twitter, but do you think that oral sex maintains the longhouse?
Oh yeah, that's definitely,
so,
like,
yeah, like, so, like, yeah, like, Palladio gives, but it gives power to Zetus to the female, even if they're symbolically taking on a subservient role. But it's like my friend Pilliter, he uses the slang, he came up with, like, the slang term, the blowjob kings. But it's like Palladio, it's like a current, it's sort of like a currency analogous to social media, but it is a way, like, it is a way to kind of create social hierarchies.
So I think you could really take a step back and just call this all daddy issues in some type of way, which is super duper old school. Like, you know, it's associated with religious conundrums as well. But it's like, yeah, seriously, kind of what's happening is there is no male leadership really at all, like, in this country. And Trump showed up and he's, like, kind of riding this line of, like, is he a good male leader or not type shit to a lot of people. And that is, like, I don't know, because
so
it's
you're
not
saying, like, someone who overcomes, like, the BJ King, the whole, like, BJ King economy, someone who supersedes that is, like,
yeah, I mean, it just, like, it's kind of overwhelmingly apparent, it's self-evident in some regards that there's an imbalance between men and women, because, like, where are the male figures that are not cucked some type of way? Like, it really is the longhouse. And without some kind of natural complementary balance, like, without some kind of that actually goes back to that tweet that went viral the other day, like, you know, are male role models gay? And it's like, no, I don't think so.
Well,
but
I mean, I think a lot of the right wing is homophobic, but the positive case, like, well, BAP obviously, like, there's this sort of quasi-homoerotic element, but I'm not necessarily anti-gay, but I think the positive of gay men is that because they're, in some ways, like, they're more independent from the longhouse, so that's, like, maybe, why BAP gets accused of being, like, pro-homosexual, but I think there is a positive element for, like, gay men being more, like, liberated to pursue things like creativity and free thought. Like, also, like, gays are more stereotypically creative, so there's, like, a positive element there. Not, like, in a liberal LGBTQ sense, but in a, like, a case for, like, for gay men in a right-wing sense, too.
Yeah, I mean, to get away from the dunking on people Twitter economy for a second, what I'm kind of getting at with that is not so much the whole gay topic, but at a certain point in your life, you kind of whatever, I'm almost coming off like I'm old all of a sudden, but it's like you go from being young and trying to have role models and, you know, mimetically develop yourself, you know, associative and operant conditioning, these kinds of things. But eventually it's like you're standing amongst equals. Like you're not looking up to somebody. You're literally in a group of peers. You know, that's kind of my boring and simplistic take on it. Like, yeah, eventually you would just be a man in your own right, like whatever weirdo that you might be, because everyone's completely nuts. But literally, yeah, you're just kind of among peers at a certain point. And that's why I think that's even a question within the sphere. Like, oh, is it gay, you know, to have role models? It's like, I don't know if one of our dudes or whatever you want to call them is like a specialist genius in some type of thing that I don't know. I mean, what am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to read their stuff, listen to their stuff, communicate with them, because Twitter's crazy. You can talk to anybody. That type of thing, you know, it's like, that's why I keep coming back to this Renaissance man idea, because it's like, why can't I just, like, your theory on, like a fellatio, mediation system for the longhouse is like exactly why I try and find independent people, because it's like, that's absolutely genius.
What do you think about like the whole idea of like the whole the concept about like cunnilingus and incels with like Stacey's? It's sort of a subversive way within the longhouse.
Yeah, I can't entirely discount that, because again,
like the right wing, the red pillars will view that as like being subservient, but they already are subservient, but they're like being granted like intimacy. So it's an interesting, like, it's an interesting symbolism.
Well, it's like, from my position, it's just one of these things where there's absolutely, that's going to happen. Like, that's just a demographic reality. Like, I might have my position over here. I'm like, I don't know. I have this whole take about how like pretty much everything is allowed except for Chad polygyny. That's like the most unacceptable sexual concept, which is it, that tells you something. I think that's interesting. Cause everything else is like being pushed extremely, but then like, I don't know, random thing. Like I was at Christmas or something and I said, you know, in front of my family, that I have multiple girlfriends, and they were like, what? And it's like, yeah, I don't know. It's strange to people. It's like forbidden. It's like unacceptable. But no, that your schema of what is probably going to occur is incredibly realistic demographically, because there's tons and tons of different kinds of people. And so these sorts of arrangements realistically will unfold, regardless of everybody's like small mindedness. Like that's a much more intelligent perspective on, sexual dynamics and what is going to happen for sure.
Before I wrap up, do you have any predictions you want to make about either the election politics? But I think one thing we didn't really get into is about the economy and like how the economic system works. But like there are these like bearish signals, but like the crash has been delayed, and like there's been all this cope about a soft landing, but it's really just the bubble's been delayed further. So before I wrap up, like what are your final predictions about the economy and the whole political situation over the next year?
Oh yeah, this one's really, really fun. So yeah, people have no idea, kind of by design, how the economic system works. This notion that fiat is just like infinite money is really not true, and that's evidenced by things like the Great Reset. So if you just go look at the World Economic Forum, what exactly is the Great Reset? Why is that happening? Well, they understand maybe from an insider perspective a lot better the structure and what's happening and the math. Like, they don't have to like it, but they looked at the math and the nature of the system.
So with the Great Reset, like, there is an angle to it that's very sinister, but I think the other angle to it, there's multiple angles, like going back to like the theme of dualism. So one angle is the more sinister conspiratorial angle, which has truth and like the oligarchs wanting to consolidate power. I think one angle is that the whole neoliberal model of the late 20th century has broken down as failing and it has to be replaced by something else. I think the third angle is a lot of people, like your average person with kind of a slavish mentality, they actually kind of embrace the whole like rentier model where everything is delivered by drones via Uber Eats and you rent, and they don't want the responsibilities of an ownership society, so you take something like the Great Reset. Like, there's many different angles you have to consider.
So I think what's really useful, I mean, I agree with you on all that, but I think what's really useful is to kind of reduce it to the most simplistic terms. So the boomers are really economically retarded in some ways. And there's really not that much of a distinction between your average middle-class boomer and, like, incredibly ultra-wealthy boomers. They do have similar mentalities in a lot of ways. So it really is structural. So on one level, sure, it's incredibly sinister. Yes, there's a lot of people that inherently and subconsciously want to give up agency. But it's also just, like, on a flip note, they really had no power at all in the whole matter. Like, the structure is, people don't realize, like, these numbers on a computer are physical. It's like, you know, overly simplified, but it's like a little magnet that, you know, it's like up, down. It's like 1, 0. It's a physical object, and it's like actual energy, which is physical. And these numbers correspond to things. Like, it's an account. It's like, you know, this is, this guy spent $700, you know, on his affair, you know, in, Kansas, you know what I mean? And they have, like, records of all this crap. And so these numbers really do correspond to every stupid thing you could possibly imagine. It's an account that isn't strictly numbers, but it's also, like, goods and services, things, like, it's a complex record of things that have happened. And yes, they are trying to change this account over, but that's, like, one of the most intractable problems you could possibly imagine. Because the math is getting to a point where, in simple terms, like, they've kind of, you could say they're incredibly economically successful, or alternatively, you could say that they stole all the money that exists, and at a certain point, like, everyone on the ground has no money, and then there is no economy, because an economy, you could have all the money in the world, but if other people don't have money, then there is no economy, and it instantly loses its value. So they found themselves in a mathematical bind where it's like,
So, yeah, like, there hasn't been a crash, but the thing is, the whole model, it's dependent upon infinite growth and money printing. So on one hand, there has not been a big crash, which the bears have been predicting, but on the other hand, like, they're stuck in this bind where they can't really go back. Like, they have to kind of keep printing. So at some point, like, either the bubble will be propped up with inflation, or they're using the whole, like, migrant crisis to prop up the migrant crisis grows the GDP and it offsets, like, wage inflation, and then, or they can use, like, high interest rates, and that makes debt more expensive, but it also means that it's more profitable for foreigners to buy U.S. debt as a hedge. So there's just all these mechanisms they can do to prop up the bubble in the economy. But I think, I mean, at some point, this whole thing needs to come crashing down like a house of cards. But so far, actually, like, the collapse bros have been saying this since, like, the zero zeros and also since the 08 crash. But so far, actually, the system, the mechanisms and power have done an okay job propping this thing up, and we haven't, like, seen the big crash, which we were expecting. But, I mean, I'm inclined to think that it's inevitable, but who knows at this point.
So here's why I was saying this is interesting, because, like, some things have changed. We really aren't in the boomer economy. There was a point just recently where we transitioned into a totally different situation that a lot of people completely missed, because, like, if you just don't see things happen and you don't know if you can't look at the math, if you can't find that stuff and look at it. But the way that the structure actually worked was not infinite money. It's that the Fed had liquidity, basically just cash on hand, as a private organization. And then that money, without going into the hyper complex, ridiculous way that it all works, it's like they finance that money out to people. So that, like, comes straight from the Federal Reserve's liquidity to pay for, like, spending bills and that kind of stuff. That's where the pool of money is that stuff comes from. They trade bonds and whatever. It doesn't matter. But it's basically that, like, this pool of money that the Fed had would be given out, and then it would kind of go back through the really complex upward money funnel back into the Fed and then be handed out over. It's a circuit. It's not infinite money. It's like, it was like $700 billion, like, just spent over and over and over and over again. Cause at the top of the economic structure, there's a different perspective. There's really only so much money that exists. I know it's a huge number, but it literally is a number that is finite. And they just spent this money over and over again, and that, you know, blah, blah, blah is really complicated, like inflation, devaluation, the petrodollar, military hegemony, all this crazy stuff going on with that. But they don't have their, like, standard pool of liquidity is, like, gone, and there's this thing called reverse repo where
I think the reverse repo, I think the expiration date for when they're going to run out, I think it's very soon, actually.
Yeah, it's like, the end of March, and it's, like, well...
So, do you think that will cause, like, a big stock market or a crash in the bond markets? Or do you think they'll be able to keep this going until at least the election?
No, I really don't think so at all, because they took a huge hit to liquidity in their main pool, and then reverse repo is whatever, it's really annoying economic stuff, but like they sell securities to really, really rich people or entities to like borrow money, and then there's a return on it. That's the incentive for people to do that, because it's a very consistent return for like large entities. But like, yeah, they've borrowed all this money and this backup pool of liquidity, which they actually used a lot of the time to kind of just manage the stability of the economy. Now that pool of liquidity is like the backup and it's rapidly disappearing. And then what happens is that like nobody can bail them out. There's like the richest people in the world, the various, I don't know, like the Saudis or somebody, they don't have the cash on hand, and they're situations are kind of stuck in a way where it's like, I can't sell all my assets and destroy my country to like bail you out. So it's kind of like a, you know, the knives at throats type situation where it's like, I'm not going to bail you out by selling all my assets, and who do I sell them to, because you don't have the cash on hand. So that's why, long story short, like Bezos and all these people are like selling their ownership of like everything to like IPO situations. They're like making all these things public. There are mass layoffs in every single industry. Tons of major corporations are shutting down.
Plus the unprecedented levels of debt, which are sensitive to higher interest rates. That's the big thing. The debt, the unprecedented levels of debt, both public and private.
Yeah, but it's like the money is kind of debt. Like, to really oversimplify things, like, the units are sort of negative, not all the types of units that exist, but, like, it's kind of all debt, which I know is really confusing for people, but it helped us kind of accelerate in terms of geopolitical competition. It's this weird thing, like, it's not entirely negative, because in a way, like, it did help us build all these gigantic things, and I can't hate on it exactly, but yes, things do kind of have to change in some type of way, but I think Klaus and all these boomers like have a pretty desperate kind of indiscriminate fucking approach, because
so they're with the Great Reset is it's a lot of things, but they're thinking about how will institutions and elites like manage this whole big collapse that's going to happen over the next several years.
You know, the simple answer is that they might have to be a little bit less rich, and that money has to kind of downward transfer, because like suddenly real economics, like real value creation, is going to be kind of forced by circumstances. My point is like, well, what even is being rich? It just really kind of means having more money than other people relative to the whole entire economy. So if they were at all intelligent, it's like, it really doesn't matter if you have like less bajillions of dollars, as long as you just have more than everyone else relative to the total size of the economy. But they're kind of insane boomers, and they don't realize a lot of the time how to like look, there's just certain assets right now that are not good to hold on to, and very practical things are suddenly going to become more valuable and more stable. Like gold is just a classic type thing. Yeah, stuff like that. So there's all these countries that are kind of rapidly realizing that and trying to acquire as much gold as they can as a kind of buffer. You know, that's useful. But yeah, in a sense, it's kind of like the weirdest thing, because they can't understand, like, maybe the numbers that you have are a little bit smaller, but what difference does that make in terms of class and status and structure and whatever? Like, you just kind of, the machine, the market forces or whatever, is just going to kind of transfer some of that money back to like a functional pleb class, like I don't know, and then it kind of stabilizes naturally. So I think they're just kind of freaking out a little bit too much about things. And it's like if you made some intelligent moves, you could just have a like a stable situation, like ongoing, like relatively stable, and things would just become a little bit more practical, and a lot of this fancy nonsense and innovation and all this stuff could continue to kind of be ridiculous, like Gemini AI. And
yeah,
all this.
Like AI will create like immense profits and transform society in the long run. But I think it's a massive cope that the AI bubble can starve off like the incoming collapse. Because like we saw like there's parallels with the .com bubble and the internet transformed society. But there was still a big like crash anyways, and like I don't think like Nvidia, the whole stock market at this point, like even Apple's declined a bit, so the whole stock market's being propped up entirely by Nvidia.
Yeah, I think the smart money is kind of like propping that up, but slowly kind of getting it out of that at the same time to create more stability. You know, so they're like, okay, we can only move so much money out of this into like other things to create more of a diverse, like, you know, kind of stable situation. And it's like, yeah, this I don't even believe AI is a thing, but this technology certainly has a lot of uses. It really can do a lot of things. I just think that it's kind of been ridiculous. My point is it can be somewhat ridiculous, and the economy doesn't instantly explode or anything. So yeah, I'm much more of an optimist about this. I'm not a collapsitarian or anything. I really just think that this sort of like parasitic like situation just kind of goes back in the other direction slightly, and it's going to be like kind of unstable for a period of time, but smart people are going to make like relatively good decisions, and I really don't think that it turns into like World War III.
You don't think like it will be like total like Mad Max collapse, and you don't predict the whole like 1984 kind of dystopian conspiracy theorist either. You actually have some reasons to be optimistic.
Well, I think economics goes, like, you want to go back to, like, BAP and some of these, like, old head type philosophies. Economics is just, like, the natural world. Animals literally trade things with each other sometimes. Stuff goes really, really deep back to nature. Like, you know, a bird collects, like, a bunch of shiny things, and he's got a slightly bigger pile of shiny things than the other male bird, and so the female chooses him type stuff. And yeah, so economics is a lot more indestructible, I think, than people think. And they kind of confuse the symbol for the like natural world, which is actually pretty durable. And so the units are a lot more flexible at times than I think people think. And I've had this whole thing about like, you know, what I picture being the case in like 20 years economically. I'm just going to hand somebody a piece of paper or a coin or whatever the hell it is, and they're going to give me a cup of coffee, and it's kind of like maybe calm down a little bit, you know? And like, sure, there's going to be credit cards and whatever. I just think it's kind of ridiculous to try and take away options. I like the mixed model that we have. Like, there are options like pieces of paper or coins, or I guess you can pay in gold if you really want to, or, you know, digitally or any of this stuff. Like even the mixed energy economy is probably a better model. Like just a little bit of everything, is a much more stable, like into the future type situation. So I just think people are kind of freaking out, but it's like, yeah, that's just cutthroat, pure capitalist economics, even with all the corruption and stupidity. Like, yeah, no, like some businesses are going to die, but Coca-Cola is like unkillable because the whole corporation could implode and somebody's just gonna buy the copyright and the blah 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 and make that shit in a bathtub for the next 5 years until somebody revives it from the dead. Because yeah, you can kind of just like, let's say this thing goes underwater, you can kind of just like acquire it and pay that off and whatever other maneuvers, and then boom, Coca-Cola just exists again. So like a lot of these things that people want to buy are lightweight, impossible to destroy because somebody will just make the formula. Somebody will just like, I think it's a lot more stable than people think it is.
Salmon Fish, we're at the end of the show. I want to thank you for being on. A great show.
Cool. Peace.